Welcome to the ABPMR Part 2 Examination Podcast. If you're preparing to take the exam this year, listen in as ABPMR board directors, Part 2 examiners, and other Part 2 experts talk all things Part 2, including the structure of the exam, scoring, study tips, what to expect on exam day, and more. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Part 2 podcast. My name is Lizzie, and I'm the communications coordinator for the ABPMR. And this is going to be a fun episode because we have two experienced ABPMR examiners on to answer frequently asked candidate questions for the Part 2 exam. So today we're joined by Dr. Maya Evans and Dr. Matt McLaughlin to help us answer some important questions about the exam. Dr. Evans is an attending physician at Shriners Children at UC Davis. And Dr. McLaughlin is attending physician at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you so much for coming on today and helping us work through these questions.
Very excited to. Thanks, Lizzie.
So can you both share how long you've been involved with the Part 2 exam? I know you're both very experienced, but can you share your background with the exam a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. I've been an examiner for 7 years now.
And I've only been an examiner for 5 years. So I have to say, Dr. Evans evidently has me by 2 years as far as being an ABPMR Part 2 examiner.
Just a couple years. Yep. Well, thank you both again for coming on today. We are going to just go through some common questions we get every year about the exam from candidates. And I know you both will have some great insight to share. So let's start with a couple of questions about notes. So as a reminder, candidates are allowed to have 2 sheets of paper for notes during the exam. Dr. Evans, what can candidates write down for their notes, or what might be some useful things that they can be writing down?
It's a great question. I think note-taking is really personal, and so it's really at the discretion of the candidate. I personally like to write down little things like ages, diagnosis, and pertinent tests, just so I have them for reference at other times in the exam. I think one pitfall to avoid is just writing down so much that it takes up a good amount of time. So I would kind of think about what's important to you and then just write down those little pieces of information.
Yeah, I agree. And we're not even able to look and see what you're writing down. So you could be drawing or doodling pictures of Pokemon characters or trying to draw the brachial plexus in 30 seconds while you're doing this. Now, that's multitasking to another level, obviously. But we don't really have any access to your notes, and we're not able to grade anything related to your notes. So as Dr. Evans pointed out, it is truly based on what's most important for you to have in person that you can re-reference. If I were retaking the Part 2 exam, the things that I would be really thinking about are the things that Dr. Evans specifically mentioned, some things that are very important that will carry through maybe through the rest of the entire case. And one of the things that I really advise people to understand is that if you want to look down at your notes, or if you want to take some time in between when we read a vignette or in between when we read a stem or a certain introductory portion of the question, you may take a couple seconds to really gather your thoughts. That's really a valuable process, and it allows you to remember to breathe during the Part 2 exam, which is something we always advise people to do.
Perfect. And then you kind of answered the next question, Dr. McLaughlin, but just to clarify, examiners will not dock points if a candidate is looking down at their notes or needs a couple of seconds to think through the case that they just heard?
No, not at all. It's part of our job as examiners to make sure that you're moving along in the case at a reasonable speed. So obviously, if you are looking at your notes for 30 seconds, we'll probably ask you to ask if we could go ahead and move along with the case. But if you're looking at your notes to really gather your thoughts or think about what questions or specific physical exam findings you may be thinking about or what specific diagnoses might come to the top of your head, those kinds of things are actually the way that I would go about examining if I were, or being an examinee if I were going through the test again, is just to try to start to think through some of the things that I would really want to know about a specific vignette, such that If the time comes and an examiner does interrupt you to ask you a specific reason why, you have some justification for that already.
Dr. Evans, will candidates be able to see the cases on their screens during the exam?
Candidates will not be able to see the any specific exam-related information on their screen. It'll simply be the the examiners. And that's part of the reason why taking little notes can be really helpful, is just to kind of have that point of reference at any point.
Yeah, so candidates will not see any sort of text or exam information on their screen. That's just for security purposes. So that's where your notes can be really helpful, writing down some specific things that will help you remember the case or information about the vignette. Dr. McLaughlin, what should a candidate do if they think they get a diagnosis wrong, or maybe if they realize later in the exam that they got a diagnosis wrong? What would you recommend for that?
Yeah, so I think that's a really great question that I'd love to answer in two parts. One, the first part is that you need to realize that each portion of the case itself are being evaluated solely based on one individual section. So there are multiple different sections that we score you on within a case. And very rarely is that solely based on whether or not you get the diagnosis correct or not. A lot of times we may be asking for a differential diagnosis, and we'd love to hear some things that are very reasonable diagnoses that you would be considering in this case. And if you don't happen to choose the one that is the exact diagnosis, we don't really dock you in that aspect of it. The second part of it is that it's really important just to remember that your performance on each section of it, as I said, is individually scored. So if you don't get the diagnosis correct, you could still do very, very well on one certain case just because of the fact that you do very well on the subsequent sections within that vignette, as opposed to solely getting the diagnosis correct or incorrect. This is not a test that solely is supposed to look at whether or not you can come up with a diagnosis or whether or not you can get to the right diagnosis. To a degree, that's part of part one. And so I think part two is a little bit different in the portions of the tests that it actually, in the portion of your skills that this actually tests.
I completely agree with Dr. McLaughlin said, and I think the most important part is that if it by chance happens to you, just remain cool. You know, all of us are high achieving, really good test takers, and we're not used to getting things wrong. And so when we do, you can feel a little shaken. But really, just like Dr. McLaughlin said, you know, it's a tabula rasa, the next section, and you just keep moving forward with it. So try to remain cool if it happens.
Great advice. And we have talked a little bit about that in past episodes, just focusing on each case, each domain, and being really present instead of thinking about something you might have said in the past. Yeah, just trying to move forward and staying present. Dr. Evans, can candidates ask their examiner to repeat the STEM, and do they get docked any sort of points, or is there a penalty if they ask to have it repeated?
It is completely okay for candidates to ask for the STEM to be repeated. And that can be a really nice way to center your thoughts if you're kind of feel like you're headed off on a tangent or kind of losing focus in the exam. There is no penalty for asking for that weak repetition. It will take away some slight time from the exam, so there'll be kind of a calibration for that. But I think it's a really nice way to refocus yourself and get back on track if you feel like the case is kind of veering in one direction.
I agree. And sometimes that's something that I would recommend for examinees to do if they may have gotten stuck trying to find a specific diagnosis, or if they've only been able to come up with maybe one or two differential diagnoses. Sometimes rehearing the STEM or hearing the STEM again is a really good way to reframe. Oh, I may have missed two or three differential diagnoses, which of course to me are now obvious, but I wasn't thinking about because I was so keyed in on maybe one or two differential diagnoses solely from the initial STEM. So I think that's really valuable test-taking strategy for some people to ask for that STEM again, or at least a portion of that STEM, just to try to find another way for the brain to think about a problem in a different way.
And I'll also add, part of our examiner training is we remind examiners that candidates might be asking examiners to repeat the STEM. So examiners are aware that candidates might ask one or a couple of times to repeat the STEM, and they're prepared for it. So it is part of their examiner training, and it's totally fine to ask to have it repeated. Dr. McLaughlin, what happens if a candidate briefly loses their connection during the exam or they have a little Zoom glitch or something like that?
Just as I said earlier, make sure you still keep breathing, which is the most important aspect of things. If you do have a challenge with the connectivity of your internet and you're not able to hear a specific response, or if you're not able to hear a full response, please just ask for us to repeat it. We're very happy to do so. Having us repeat a portion of it will not really affect your scoring or grading by any means. And also, this is a test of your own knowledge and your own patient abilities and interaction with individuals. It's not a test of your internet connection. And so we don't dock you, or we don't decrease your score because of the challenges you may have from an internet perspective, because we also sometimes have those challenges ourselves. I think we as examiners are trained during our robust training to essentially wait for a couple minutes for you to potentially rejoin the room. So if you do lose connectivity to the room, please try to rejoin as quick as you can. We then adjust the length of time that we have available to administer the exam for you. You're not going to be docked or have minutes taken away from your ability to perform as best as you can. And so please just know that we have some flexible time in between different examinees that we have built in for potential technical difficulties.
And like you just said, if it's a minute or two, candidates should not worry if they're able to reconnect to the Zoom session. And next week on the next episode, I'll go into a little bit more about what happens if you were to lose connection and you can't get back into the Zoom meeting. So if it's a minute or two, do not worry. Your examiner will adjust the time. If it's a little Zoom glitch too, if there's a momentary freeze or a lapse in audio, don't worry about that either. And you can definitely, like we mentioned, ask for your examiner to repeat something if you missed some audio. So basically, don't worry about those little technical difficulties. Dr. Evans, can you go into a little bit about examiner training and how examiners prepare for the exam?
It's a great question. Just like Dr. McLaughlin mentioned, it is a robust training where we meet with a variety of AB Chem and Art experts and board members to review the format and the cases. We also get extensive training in the software that we use. So it's a highly standardized process that we all complete and do together.
Yeah, and this is now our third year of examining virtually. And so several of us who have gone through this process in a virtual way now have the technical component down very, very well. And so it's now getting to the point that we're now getting to the ability to move in between all of these software systems very seamlessly. And so please always give us a little bit of grace if we are taking a few seconds in between each domain or reading each portion of a STEM, because it's important for us to kind of make sure that we move things along in each of the software systems that we're trying to manage.
And you spoke a little bit to experienced examiners. I am very involved in helping with examiner training, and I can also assure everyone, new examiners, they get a little bit of extra training sessions just so that they are fully prepared for the exam, especially the remote exam. So experienced and new examiners, they both have extensive training and they dedicate a lot of time to making sure that they're ready to administer the exam. Dr. McLaughlin, what happens if a candidate needs a second to collect their thoughts or if they pause a little bit during the exam? How does that work?
Yeah, I think that's a completely wise thing to consider doing, especially after first hearing the STEM for the first time or as you're writing things down on a piece of note paper, because I think that what that allows you to do is really recollect your thoughts or frame your thoughts in a way that allows you to go forward and score as well as you may be able to on a certain domain. And that's one of the things that I probably would do, although usually doing things in a very deliberate way is not one of my strengths. So I would say that probably the best way for people to do it is think about how they are as a test taker, and know that even if you spend some time thinking about things before responding, that's not going to mean that you're going to have a poor score on a certain portion of an exam. If you immediately start asking questions or immediately dive into things, it doesn't mean that you're going to get a better score on the exam. And so I think that's just one of those things that we as examiners are trained to think about the responses that examinees have, as opposed to the speed that they provide them or the rapid fire ability that they have to provide certain differential diagnoses. And I think that's a very important thing, because I think many people believe that the faster that you say things, or the more quick that you say things, the more you're showing that your knowledge. And we as examiners are trained to essentially think about all of the things that you are saying as opposed to the speed in which you are saying those things.
That's a great point. I'm so glad you went into that because, yeah, that is such an important distinction to make. Is there anything you wanted to add to that, Dr. Evans?
I think when the candidate is speaking, you get a lot of information into their thought process. And so I really appreciate that time and seeing how their thoughts unroll and how they're organized. And I think that's a really powerful sign of how they're doing rather than necessarily getting all the words out quickly. So I think, you know, pausing for organization can be a really helpful tool for candidates to use.
As you saw, even in the answer to this question, I immediately started talking and Dr. Evans did a great job of pausing and collecting her thoughts. So very characteristic of both Dr. Evans and myself. So.
Right. And I love how you said it's helpful for organization. Like if it's going to help candidates organize their thoughts a little bit better, absolutely take the pause and don't worry about immediately diving into your explanation. So it's really whatever works best for the candidates and getting their thought process across. Dr. Evans, so we have talked in past episodes about how there are two examiners during an exam session, and one examiner will be talking at a time, and the other examiner is just sitting and listening. So can you explain why one examiner is only talking during the exam, and then what the silent examiner is doing?
For sure. So in your room, there will be two examiners, and one will be doing cases at a time. So one will be interacting with you and the other will be observing. It's an interesting system. It provides a lot of benefits that I don't think, you know, people realize at first glance, but if one of the examiners were to have connectivity issues, then the second examiner can pop right in. So it's kind of an insurance policy that the exam continues if one of the examiners has connectivity issues. And then the other one is that the examiner who's silent is observing the process and taking in all the information. And then that examiner is grading the candidate as well. So it gives us kind of a set of checks and balances and an insurance policy that the exam will proceed as smoothly as possible. So those are all the reasons for them being there.
Is there anything you wanted to add, Dr. McLaughlin?
I think going back to the time when Dr. Evans and I first started examining as an in-person exam, we were very limited in the ability to provide a large number or a robust number of scores. And one of the things that doing this virtually has allowed us to do is to have multiple people in an exam room scoring at the same time. And so I think what it does is it gets rid of that fear or worry in my mind from an examinee perspective of the fact that they just may have one very tough examiner because we're having a lot more scoring that's occurring, essentially meaning that some of that, some of those far ends of the spectrum from a scoring gets evened out and essentially makes it more realistic in the way that those responses and scores are occurring.
And we just had Dr. Michaela Raditz on, who's our senior psychometrician at the ABPMR, and she did a great job of explaining how two examiners contributes to the validity of the exam. And then she also went into a little bit about how the exam is adjusted for examiner severity too. So that is our scoring episode if anyone's interested in learning more about that. But that's a great explanation from both of you. And then last question, Dr. McLaughlin. Why candidates might be wondering during the exam, they're talking, they're going through their thought process, and then their examiner interrupts them. Why did their examiner interrupt them?
Yeah, the reason why we may interrupt you, especially during the first domain, is because that's one of the opportunities we are trying to dive deeper or understand maybe your thought processes a little bit better. And really, it's an opportunity for you as an examinee to show kind of your extra level of knowledge that you may have accumulated. For instance, if you are very keenly aware of aspects of prosthetic use or something like that, and you may say something that sparks a question for us, that may be a great opportunity to get into starting to talk about specific prostheses and why you would choose one versus another. If you're really into sports medicine, for instance, and, you know, certain maneuvers of the shoulder. And we ask, why did you choose that specific maneuver? What would you want to see from that? That's really an opportunity for you to shine. And so a lot of times when we interrupt you, it's not because we're attempting to be mean. It's an aspect of us trying to attempt to dive deeper on a section where we feel that you may have some advanced knowledge based on some of the information that you already provided in your response.
Anything you wanted to add to that, Dr. Evans?
Yeah, I think it's just a great opportunity to keep the flow of the examination going and to just help the candidate do the best job that they can and help them get all their knowledge out. So it's not a ding or an insult. It's just kind of to help the flow of the examination.
Examiners sometimes do need to interrupt you on specific domains to move you through a specific case in a reasonable amount of time. As we said earlier, that's our responsibility as examiners is to try to get you through a specific case in a reasonable amount of time to make sure you're able to showcase your knowledge over several different cases as opposed to just over one case. And so we may interrupt at other domains solely from a time perspective, as that's one of the things that we're paying attention to as examiners while the case is occurring.
Yeah, I was going to add the timing thing, so I'm glad you mentioned that. But that just goes back to examiners are in charge of keeping the pace of the exam going. So if they need to move on, they might interrupt you just so that they can move on and keep the exam on time. So those are some frequently asked questions about the exam. Is there anything else you'd like to add or say to Part 2 candidates this year?
I'd just like to wish the candidates good luck. You all worked really hard to get here, and this is kind of the last step on your journey to board certification. So although it's a challenge to study during fellowship or the time that you're working, just know that you're in the home stretch. There's a group around the country practicing just like you, and you'll be there. It can be intimidating to step into or to log into a Zoom room with two other examiners, but we're really here for you and we're rooting for you, and we're going to help you showcase your abilities in multiple domains and multiple cases.
Yeah, that last portion of what you said, that we, I think, as examiners are really rooting for the examinees, is very important and very characteristic, I think, of all of us that choose to do this as a volunteer aspect of our own time to serve the ABPM&R in this way. And one of the things that I've always loved about being a Part 2 examiner is it's really fascinating and wonderful to watch people who had entered this field three and a half years ago as PGY2 level residents with maybe very little knowledge of the field of the intricacies of PM&R, really showcasing that they are specialists in physical medicine and rehabilitation. And to me, that's one of the best aspects of the volunteer job that we get to do, is that we really see that evolution from most people as a PGY1 who may be able to consult PM&R to being on that other end of the consult request, providing the highest level of care for some of our patients that need physical medicine and rehab. So it's really a thing for, I think, both Dr. Evans, myself, and all the other Part 2 examiners, that we really love what we do. And we really come back year after year to see the progress that you guys have made as residents and as you progress to being board certified in PM&R.
I love that you mentioned that, because we do hear that from most of our examiners. They truly just love seeing the future of the field and getting to examine the next generation of physiatrists. So they're definitely on your team. They're rooting for you. They're trying to help you do your best. And I think you two are perfect examples of that.
Dr. Evans and I are not too old, though. Can we say that please, real quick, Lizzie?
That's right.
Can we still be part of this generation?
Right. You're still count it. Yep.
Thank you.
If you're looking for more information on anything we talked about today, or maybe you had a question that we didn't get to today, you can check out our Part 2 podcast page on the ABPM&R News Center that links to almost all of the Part 2 exam resources that we have on our website. And so hopefully you can find an answer to any question that you might have and more information on what we talked about today. So next week will actually be our final episode of the podcast, because the exam is coming right up. So I'm going to be joined by an ABPM&R staff member, and we're going to talk through an entire exam day. So we'll go through the check-in process and then what to expect before, during, and after your exam day, so that you hopefully feel extremely prepared going into exam day, knowing what to expect. But thank you so much to Dr. Evans and Dr. McLaughlin for being on today. I always love talking with you both.
Wonderful to do it. Thank you, Lizzie.